I love the topic of why we practice. What are we doing? What are we doing here? Why do we keep showing up? What is it that is inside of us that motivates us, excuse me, to sit, to meditate, to explore these teachings? So in thinking about that, I want to share with you, because this is the first time that I've taught this class, my own story. Where did I come from? Why do I practice? And maybe it's not very different from anybody else's, but I'll just share with you the story, where it came from. As I was raising children who are now adults, this happened about 20 years ago, when my kids were about 7 or 8, we had the typical little house in a subdivision, and one day my husband brought a trampoline home. And I thought, oh my God, I don't want a trampoline. I really don't want a trampoline. And the kids were thrilled. They got this trampoline. And we had this fenced yard, and my husband put the trampoline out there. And we had a German Shepherd at the time, Maggie, who was, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old. And the kids were out after school one day. I was making dinner, and I could see out the back of the kitchen window this trampoline where they were. And they were out there having a good time, and pretty soon they got into a little argument, and they're bickering back and forth, and I was ignoring them. And then the next thing I knew, I heard my daughter scream. I heard my son scream for me, "Mom, Mom, Mom, Sarah fell off the trampoline." And I looked at her, and she was laying on the ground, and she was holding her elbow, and the dog, who was in heat, was over next to her trying to help her. And my son was upset. He was about a year younger than Sarah. She was 8 years old at the time. And the nurse in me, I used to be a nurse, knew she broke her arm or she broke her elbow. My husband at the time was out of town. So he was out of town with the family car, and all I had was his big, huge diesel work truck stick shift. And so I ran outside, I got Sarah, I got the bag of peas, I loaded everybody up in the truck, including the dog who was in heat, and knew I needed to get to the ER. I dropped my son off at a friend's house. We went to the ER, left the dog in the car, went in, and sure enough, Sarah had quite a fracture of her elbow. So over the ensuing year or so, she had a lot of physical therapy. But before all of this happened, she was on the swim team. She was on the Humboldt Swim Club, you know, the kids who go after school and they're swimming. And she had beautiful butterfly stroke. And I was always so enamored to sit in the bleachers and watch her swim. It was incredible. I mean, is anybody a swimmer here? So do you know? I mean, it was unbelievable to be able to coordinate, I think, the body and the breathing with the butterfly stroke of all things. So it was sad because this elbow fracture was pretty much the end of her butterfly stroke, because it was bad and it took a lot of healing, and every time she would swim, she'd get tendonitis, and so it really was the end of that. So after a while, at least a year or so, when she'd become sort of a couch potato, I said to her, "So Sarah, what are you going to do? What kind of exercise would you like?" She said, "Well, I'd take a yoga class." And I was pretty surprised. And I said, "Okay, well, can I come with you?" And she said, "Yeah, okay." So she invited a friend, and the three of us took an intro to yoga class. And I had practiced some yoga when I was in college, but now this was a while later, and it's now 20 years ago. And so we took this yoga class, and she and her friend did the 3 weeks of the class, and then they went on and said, "I'm not doing that anymore." And I stayed. And I continued to practice, and it became an extremely integral part of my life. And through that practice, I began to meditate, because it was such a natural, the way the yoga and meditation goes together. And I was lucky, I had a teacher who really integrated meditation into her teaching. And it felt like I was just sliding right into the right place of where I needed to be in my life. And then one day, this same teacher brought me one of Sylvia's books. And I read that book, and I knew I needed to find Sylvia. I needed to read her books. I needed to find a way to get to know her, to come to her classes. And that's what happened. That's pretty much what happened. But what's so interesting to me and what that has to do with mindfulness and meditation really is that it really is an example of causes and conditions occur. We've got no control of them. And one thing leads to the next, to the next, to the next. And we see it all the time. It goes on and on and on like that. So am I grateful that Sarah fell off the trampoline and fractured her elbow? Not really. But yes, that what it led to. Because I think that had she not fractured her elbow, she would have kept swimming. I may not have come back to yoga, but I got back to yoga. I had a great teacher who introduced me to Sylvia, and I kept banging on Sylvia's door until she said, okay. And so here we are. So it's sweet, you know, it's really very sweet how those things happen. So we know that things happen because other things happen. We know that the Buddha taught that because of this, that, and we see it repeatedly. So why I practice, why I'm here, and what sustains me, they're really two sides of the same coin. It's that through the practice, I've really come to know myself in a way that I don't think I ever would have known myself. And I remember really early on in practice thinking that it was such a vast inner landscape. How was I ever going to explore all this? That was on the one hand. The other hand was, oh my God, there's so much to learn. It's such a vast inner landscape. I can't wait to explore all of this. Anybody else have that experience? It's wonderful. It's wonderful to sit down and just be with whatever is here. And it certainly takes a degree of courage, a degree of willingness, a lot of curiosity, the capacity to tolerate the sticky and icky stuff. And just like what we do with each other, of talking about our joys and our sorrows, it expands our tolerance, it expands our resilience. And I think that practice has changed me profoundly. And I would guess that for those of us who've been practicing a while, you would agree that it's changed you in some way. In some way, we've really been changed by this. So often when I teach, somebody will say, can you just tell me, oh my goodness, I have to tell you that I am missing what I wanted to read. How do we describe what meditation is? How do we do that? And there's a teacher in LA, her name is Karen Mazin Miller. She's a Zen priest who you may have read one of her books. She's written several. One is called Zen Mama. The other more recent one is Paradise in Plain Sight. And it's her story of renovating an amazing garden over many, many years. But what she says is this. I do have it. These days, I want nothing more than to enter an empty room with a group of strangers and sit still and quiet in samadhi, non-distracted awareness, for the better part of the day. I'm always astonished by the presence of people who would dare to do such a thing, burn perfectly good daylight to get nothing done. To take responsibility for peace in your world is genuinely heroic. Practicing meditation can be hard on your stiff body and restless mind, but it does not hurt anyone. No one is harmed by your practice. Indeed, everyone is helped. When you are still, no eyebrows are arched, no fists are clenched, no fingers are tapped, no sideways glances are given. When you are quiet, nothing mean, cruel, or critical is said. We have the power to transform everything when we have the courage to do nothing. Isn't that amazing? This is a courageous practice. It's a radical thing to sit down, feel yourself in your chair, on your cushion, however you are, in your own body as you are now, and just feel that. To try to let go of the judgment about it, the stories we tell ourselves about it, all of the internal monologue that's happening, whether it's the critic or the praiser. But just to be here is really courageous. And I love this, these two specific lines. To take responsibility for peace in your world is genuinely heroic. It's a tall order, but we do it bit by bit. We just do it bit by bit. And we do have the power to transform everything when we have the courage to do nothing, because we know we're not doing nothing. We really know that when you sit and you practice, we got a lot going on. And we have those moments of peace. We have those bliss moments, but aren't they moments? They just go, and then it's difficult again. And we're just here. We're just here with it. So that was how I came to this. And I'm still here, and I love it. And, you know, it's really wonderful. So then the meat of the practice started happening. And it's been many years, and last year I got in the mail one of those beautiful, glossy catalogs that sells outdoor gear, high-end, gorgeous outdoor gear. And this catalog that is full of incredible photographs of very beautiful places that most people probably can't ever go to, but we get to go to vicariously through reading these catalogs. And if we buy the beautiful clothing and the beautiful gear, we're also vicariously living in those places. So the front of this catalog showed a man, probably around 40, trail running. And he was in exceptionally good shape, had all the right gear on, and the photo was like being in the high Rockies, and the sun is shining, there's some billowy clouds, and he's running on this crusty, rocky trail, getting to the crest of this mountain, and you can just see that he's worked so hard. And just the picture itself makes you want to say, go, 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 you can do it, you're going to get there. And the caption is, suffer better. I thought that was brilliant. I thought it was really brilliant, because either the person who thought that up had some sort of Buddhist practice and maybe knows the Four Noble Truths, or maybe somebody just said, this stuff is just suffering. Okay, so if I put all this gear on, I can suffer better. But what I was thinking is, all right, so we are managing our suffering. And as Sylvia has said a million times, suffering, the definition of suffering, is the imperative in the mind that things be other than what they are. We are constantly in that tension, that place of I want it, I don't want it, I want it, I don't want it. And it's in that lack of acceptance with what is happening right now, our inability to just be with the unpleasant, that we suffer. Donald also will define suffering as learning to be with the unpleasant. So not to confuse what suffer better is or what suffering is, but if we look at the First Noble Truth, that in life there is suffering, as opposed to the misunderstanding that life is suffering, how are we going to manage this? How are we going to say, all right, life is challenging, we know that. There's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of stress, there's pain, there's sadness, there's beauty and joy and delight, and we can't know sorrow without knowing joy. We can't know happiness without knowing sadness. We know that. So how do we suffer better? Do we suffer by buying more stuff? You know, that was what came to me, is that I looked at this and thought, okay, so yeah, I'd like one of those and one of those and one of those, and my own personality is that I really like cozy socks. Well, how many pairs of cozy socks do I need? Am I going to suffer better if I have four different sweaters that are all, you know, make me feel good. So one of the, this brought to mind for me was a teaching that Larry Yang also likes to teach. Are you familiar with Larry? He's a regular teacher here and founder of East Bay Meditation Center. He gives us the teaching that comes from the Buddha, five bites from full. Anybody familiar with that? How can we live our lives five bites from full? And I don't think it's meant literally, you know, how do we know when we're five bites from full? But how do we gauge and measure what is enough? Gauge and measure our satisfaction. So the catalog arrives and says, suffer better by buying all of this stuff. So can we catch ourselves right when we start taking the bait? Isn't that the trick? How do we catch ourselves when we're taking the bait in our interactions with other people, taking the bait from the stories we tell ourselves? That's another one of the really important things that Donald has taught over and over again, is watch the stories you tell yourself. And we do tell ourselves stories all the time. Some of them are really accurate. They're quite effective. They're quite supportive. And some of them aren't. So do we have the wisdom, that discerning capacity to say, I'm telling myself a story right now? Is it a reactive story? Is it just one that we want to tell ourselves? Yeah, I need those two jackets. Maybe we do. So it's not so much to judge the stories, but to disentangle what's real and what's not. And that's why we sit. We're disentangling what supports us and what doesn't support us. So I like that. I like that, the teaching of five bites from full. I have found it to be incredibly beneficial in my life to gauge satisfaction and to see how satisfaction changes. So if we go to the teaching that life is basically unsatisfactory as a definition of suffering, I don't really see it like that. That's not how I work with it. I think that life is profoundly satisfying, and the levels of satisfaction change. What we experience changes all the time. So we indeed can suffer better. But I want to qualify that it isn't all suffering. Are you with me on that? So this is a hard practice, right? It's really hard. We sit down, we do it over and over and over again. And sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not. And can we tolerate those times that we sit here and we're so restless, or we're worried, or there's so much anxiety, and you cannot wait for the bell to ring? You just can't wait for the bell to ring. And then the bell rings, and then we have the sense, oh, I could sit here a little bit longer. What is that about? You know, it's like we get this imperative. That's the imperative in the mind, that things should be different than they are. All right, I've already done this. I want to get on to the next subject. Well, okay, you can go on to the next subject. Well, I actually don't need to. This is actually okay. So we see the ways things are already okay. Rick Hansen has a beautiful explanation of this, where he says, are you familiar with Rick Hansen, the neuropsychologist? We are almost always all right, right now. We are almost always all right, right now. That's been a very beneficial teaching for me. Because when we really look at what is happening right now, not what happened before and not what I'm anticipating is going to happen, I really find out how okay I actually am. Because it is right now. And sometimes I'm not okay right now. I think that it's important to recognize also that we do have difficulties. But the difficulties we don't need to become our difficulties. We can be a little bit separate from that. This comes from the Zen master Kogen Chino Roshi. The more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task, so naturally such a person sits down for a while. That's the beauty of our practice. We have to sit down for a while. And imagine if everybody would sit down for a little while. Things could calm, we could clear, we can make better choices. I love that. The more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task, so naturally such a person sits down for a while. So I want to share with you now some of the teachings from both Donald and Sylvia that have had specific impact and import for me, and then we'll talk with each other about it as well. So I will start with Donald. Donald has been very, very direct about staying in the body, staying in our bodies. Have you heard him talk about how you can really work with the capacity to have awareness of what is happening in your body while you're in an interaction with somebody, and how difficult that is? Because we are so much in our conversations all the time. But to maintain some level of, I feel my feet on the ground, I can actually feel my hands while I'm talking, that helps moderate the pace of my thoughts. It helps moderate what I say also. So I think that that piece of staying in our bodies is incredibly important, and it pervades so much. If we can just, you know, stay there a little bit, it keeps our balance. So how many times have we all been in the grocery store at 5 o'clock at night and we get in what we think is the shortest line, the checkout line, right? And we start getting frustrated because we just have a couple of things, and then the person in front of us pulls out all the coupons and it's 5 o'clock, right? Can we be patient enough and tolerant enough to be happy that there are coupons for this person who needs the coupons? That's the generosity of spirit. And can we stand there, feel our feet on the ground, literally, feel our feet on the ground, feel the breath coming and going, and it helps stabilize, balance, and calm our nervous system so we don't have to get lost in this person's taking so long, it's 5 o'clock, I gotta get out of here, I've been at work all day. We went to the store at 5 o'clock. What's gonna happen, you know, it's 5 o'clock. So staying in the body is really helpful wherever we are. It manages our stress. It calms the central nervous system. There is a functional system. There's a functional purpose physiologically to staying in our bodies and what it does to calm the central nervous system. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. Watch the stories you tell yourself. That's another teaching from Donald that is so important. And I talked a little bit about that. Anybody practiced with that a bit? You know, yeah. Yeah, we practice with that a lot. A lot. There was a time where I was talking with Donald about some difficulty that I was having with a person who is very dear to me. And I was getting very, very triggered, and it was hard, and I was having a lot of pain, and I was really trying to get outside of my own righteousness about not liking what the situation was. And it was very important to me to have as much peace and ease in this relationship that was difficult. And he said to me, tune into her pain and you'll be in your right mind. Tune into her pain and you'll be in your right mind. That is one of the most important pieces of advice I've ever received. Because more than anything, I want to be in my right mind. So when I started thinking about what does it mean to be in my right mind, that opened up a huge area of practice for me. Because I want to be kind, I want to be generous, I want to be resilient, I want to have boundaries, for sure. I want to have boundaries, but I want to be wise about those boundaries. And I want to be able to step out of the center of my own reactivity to whatever the situation is and have enough capacity to say, okay, this is what's happening for this person. It's actually not about me. This is not personal. One of our three marks of experience, right? That it's not about us. It's not self. It's not about me. This is somebody else's experience. So tune into her pain and you'll be in your right mind. I want to be in my right mind. I want to be in my right heart. That was really important. And the last one from Donald that isn't so much what he has said, but how he is. You know, Donald has a very deep commitment to wise speech and to speech practice. And some of us all know this. And to watch somebody and work with a teacher who is so wise about his speech and how he interacts is a role model. It's really modeling how we can take what the Buddha taught about, is it kind, is it useful, does it have good timing, is it necessary, and watch it in action. And I believe that Donald is human, and I imagine that it's not always so perfect for him, but I've learned a lot from that. So that's been a very important one, and it's on my mind a lot. I really think about my own language, and of course I blow it, of course. But it's there. It's there as a guide. So those are the four things that I really wanted to share with you about Donald that are really beautiful. Being in your body, empathy, tuning into somebody else's pain, watching our stories, and being careful with our speech. Sylvia. What's laughing? So I think some of these will be all very familiar to you. Sweetheart, you're in pain. Take a breath. And we laugh because we love this. This is really a sweet acknowledgement that is really wonderful that she's given this teaching. So what I love about sweetheart, you're in pain. Take a breath is number one, sweetheart, to call ourselves by a name that is endearing, that holds us with this kindness, this care, immediately cuts through any judgment, any blame, any self-recrimination. It just cuts that out. So whatever name you use, your own name maybe, but said with care, sweetheart. You're in pain. What does that do? Essence of mindfulness. It names what's happening. It doesn't judge it. It doesn't blame it. It just says, you're in pain. And take a breath. It gives us something to do about it. As little as that is, take a breath. It inserts an intentional pause. It allows us to say, okay, what's going on here? So I think it's a brilliant tool for difficulty so we can suffer better. So when we're in that moment, when pain has become suffering and we're trying to manage, when we can name it and see it and hold ourselves with that care, with that kind heart, it really is beautiful. And the take a breath, once again, is physiologically functional. I mean, how many times have we all said, I just need some space. I got to go take a walk. I need to breathe. Because we do. Because it puts us back into balance. We really need that ability for our higher thinking processes. Here's another one I love from Sylvia. The mind is like tofu. Whatever it marinates in will become the flavor of the mind. So choose what kind of mind you want to have. So you want to marinate it in sweet sour sauce? You can have a little of both. You're going to, you know, what do you want to have? So this goes back to the Buddha's teaching. What the mind frequently thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. Same thing with the heart, right? Whatever we can really incline our hearts towards kindness and goodwill, or we can stay in that bitter place. So we really have a choice about what kind of mind we want to have. And when we sit in meditation, we see what kind of mind is here today. And we just see it. That's it. We don't need to judge it. We don't need to blame it. We don't need to intentionally change it. It will change. But when we do these practices of goodwill and compassion, metta practice, it does change us. It changes our mind. So the mind really is like tofu. And I said already Sylvia's definition of suffering as the imperative in the mind, that things be different than they are. And it's interesting, you know, she says that quite a lot. And it took me a long time to get it. And have you noticed that with, you know, you can hear these teachings over and over and over again. And most of the time, we kind of take them in. And every once in a while, we get it. Boom. I finally got it. How many times has she said that? But that's just how we are. It's just how we learn. So I've been really watching my own imperatives lately and understanding that tipping point of where difficulty moves into suffering that's unnecessary. And the last two she talks about all the time, peace is possible, the third noble truth. What a beautiful interpretation of that there is an end of suffering. Peace is possible. And just what Karen Mazin Miller says, is that to take responsibility for peace in your world is genuinely heroic. So how do we find these moments of peace? That's what we need to do, is notice those times where things are okay. I'm almost always all right right now. That's the peace. And they build on each other. So it is possible. And then Sylvia also talks a lot about what is either the second or last thing that the Buddha said, translated by the scholar Andy Olensky, move into the future with confidence. And we've all heard her say that. And that can be very tricky. We live in a difficult world, right? Things are really tough. And so we can get depressed and stuck and numb and paralyzed. How am I supposed to move into the future with confidence? Well, again, we take baby steps. We come back to what are we doing right now in this moment? Practice, I sit, that gives me the confidence to sit again, to see things a little more clearly. As we see a little more clearly and get less reactive, more responsive, and our hearts open, we get a little confident. Not overly confident, it's a faith in the practice that we know supports us, that we can move to the next day, to the next moment. So those are the things that I really love from Sylvia and Donald. And I would love, we can do this a couple of different ways. We can either pair off and take a couple of minutes to talk with one another about what we've all experienced, or we can do it as a group. Is there any preference? Group? Okay, that's overwhelming. That's group. So we've got time. Do we have a microphone?
Oh, we do.
That'd be great. So what I would like to do, there are two questions to answer, your choice. Either, what is something that I've learned from Sylvia and or Donald that's been really important and why? Or if that's not the question you want to address, the other question is, what brings you to practice? Why are you here? What is it? And we can just go around. We've got time. Yes, Marty.
Since I'm holding the microphone. When I first came here to Spirit Rock, and Donald, I think was the first, may have been the, I think he was the first teacher I encountered. And the teaching which he has given again and again and again is about the two arrows. Mm-hmm. And I just see how true that is. It has to do with the suffering again. That life does have pain in it, but we invariably have the tendency, unless we catch ourselves, to add to the pain, the suffering with our stories and our recriminations and our blame and make it so much worse for ourselves. So the two arrows, the teaching that we all experience the first arrow, but the second arrow is optional. And then the thing that from Sylvia that I love is everyone is doing the best they can. And that helps so much with any kind of judgment. I mean, I think that it also has to do with what you were talking about, being able to put yourself in another person's place and see what it is that's going on for them that may make whatever is happening their personal best in that moment. And then the third thing, which I just really hit on, it comes to this experience of hearing something again and again and again, and then it just... I was just on retreat last week, and I spent 2 days just in total self-recrimination about my identification with my body. And I had a really hard time not personalizing it. Mm-hmm. The teaching is causes and conditions. Everything that happens comes together in you as the way you happen to experience it, but it's not personal. It has to do with all the causes and conditions that have come together. And it's really not personal. So taking, not blaming myself or getting into all of the things about how I should be, how I could be different. No. But seeing, oh, that's interesting. Causes and conditions. Huh. Curiosity. Wonder why this is particularly going on for me right now. Looking at it, identifying it, and holding yourself in compassion. That was my learning on this retreat, and so I'm very happy to have this opportunity to share it.
Thank you. I would like to say what the teaching of the two arrows is for anybody who is unfamiliar with that. So what that teaching is, the Buddha taught, is that life, living life, the pain of our lives, is normal. It's what's going to happen. And it is like getting shot with an arrow. We all experience pain, difficulty, challenge. That's the first arrow. But how we respond to that pain of that first arrow is the key. And so often, by default, we shoot another arrow, or four, or five, or a whole quiver, because we get hurt and we shoot it back. So the point is, we do not shoot the second arrow. And that the commitment is, the violence stops with me. So we feel the pain, we say, ouch. We get to know what that is, and we're skillful about how we respond. So that is the teaching of the two arrows. We do not fire back. Anybody else? Thank you.
Sylvia said everyone's doing the best they can, she also adds, if they could do better, they would.
Thank you.
And that's the part that gets me, because if you say someone's just doing the best they can, it's to me it was always, oh, you're letting them off the hook, come on, get over it, you know, like somebody has to be held responsible for this. And so I would go into a whole thing, and then she said, if they could do better, they could. And I thought, yeah. And if I could do better, I could too.
You would.
And I would. Yeah, I would. And then I started seeing, trying to apply that to other people. And then I realized that it does go back to causes and conditions. And that if somebody, you know, cuts in front of me on the highway and they didn't use their directional light, maybe they're trying to get to the hospital, or maybe someone just had an argument, or maybe nobody taught them to put on their directional light. And that really takes a lot of the pressure, helps me with my judgments and of other people and also of myself. And when other people who haven't studied Buddhism, don't know anything about this, they sit there and start complaining about what someone just did to them, and how awful it is, and then how guilty they feel. I say, this is what I heard from Sylvia. Everyone's doing the best that they can. If they could do better, they would. And it seems to stop them from telling me more of the story, which I don't really want to hear. And it seems to give them some peace. So,
thank you. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah.
I just want to add a little piece to what Adrian just said. It's the same, but a little bit different. Sylvia said sometimes when people ask her how she is, she answers, I couldn't be better, which is the same thing. If I could be, I would be. But it's, you know, again, causes and conditions, but people go, wow, really that great? It's like, not necessarily, but if I could be better, I would be. So this is how I am with it, and whatever's great or not great out there, it's up to me to be how I be with it, and I couldn't be better. It is a great, I love that answer.
Yeah.
And that attitude.
Thank you.
This is in answer to the question of how I came to this particular practice.
Great.
I started meditating when I was 20 years old, and my tradition was transcendental meditation. And I practiced that for a very, very long time. And I got to a point where I was dissatisfied with two aspects of it. One is that, this is kind of an oversimplification, if you just meditate, everything will be okay.
Yeah, right.
Right? That turned out not to be actually true. And then if you meditate long enough and seriously enough, you will really reach this state of enlightenment. Okay, so that was like the goal out there. And so I came to this practice here because although I'm very content with my meditation practice, I wanted guidance. I wanted the ethical component, not just the meditation, but the ethical component. How do I live my life in a way that is better for me and better for everybody else? And that I have found in abundance in the teachings that I've received here. And the teaching from Sylvia that helps me with this idea of enlightenment is that enlightenment had been in my mind this perfect condition where you remain permanently. Mm. And Sylvia says that there are moments of enlightenment. Yeah. And maybe those moments will become more frequent. Maybe they will last a little bit longer. But that is enlightenment for me now.
Thank you for bringing that up. And I think that goes back to peace is possible, that these moments add up, that we have these times where those moments where we learn something that we've heard many, many times, I finally got it, that's a moment of awakening. That moment of understanding things at a deeper level where all these things come together, that's a moment of awakening. And I think when we understand and work with this idea of enlightenment and awakening, it can be really overwhelming. But just to take it in these baby steps of moments and to see how these moments add up to a more peaceful life. I think that's where she's going with that. I thank you for bringing that up. I think that's really important. Anybody else? Yeah, it's back.
To me, Sylvia and Donald both don't really have to say a word. Mm. They are living those feelings and they just come at you all over.
That's beautiful. Thank you. And in the back. I think that I'd just like to say to that, I think that we all do that. I think that as we practice and as we integrate these teachings and we include the ethical component in our mindfulness, which is so vital, that we become the practice. And all of us here are wise. And Sylvia and Donald are really important teachers for us. But we're all like that. So I would give you a lot of support for you two. You two. Yeah.
Well, I want to echo on what she was just saying about they're not having to say anything. I want to can Sylvia's laugh. I take it around with me in my head all the time, and when it's just crazy, I just go, just laugh like Sylvia. And another thing she said was, which again is an echo of what you just read, we were talking about, people had gone around the room and said things they were thinking about, and there was all this chaos and all these problems, and then in my own life it was a particularly chaotic time, and she said, but just think about it. In this moment now, we're all sitting here, and in this moment now, we're just fine. So I just pick that up, and I go around, and in the middle of all this chaos, I'm going, in this moment now, I'm just fine. And that really helps a lot. And I've even passed it on to other people, and they go, wow, that's a good idea.
That's great.
And with Donald, there were many things with both of them, but I remember he wrote a book about dealing with the corporate world or the nonprofit world and in using your practice so that you can have an impact, but you do it through a practice so that you have the result that you're looking for, thinking that it is the right and best result without being killing each other like they do in the corporate world. Mm-hmm. And I pass that on to many people, especially men, and it's just spoken to them so much, and I think it does and has helped peace in the world so much.
That's
so I think
great.
He should really be applauded.
His
for that.
Book, if anybody is interested, is called The Engaged Spiritual Life, and it's in the bookstore, and it's beautiful. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. It explores all of these teachings from a social justice perspective. Anybody else? Yes, over here.
I want to share something that Donald taught me that had a big impact. And it's this concept of a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really important for me, especially in dealing with pain. And the concept of this ladder is at the bottom rung is like all the data, information we deal with. And then the next rung is focusing on a specific piece of data or information. And then we make assumptions about that,
can
whatever
you hold
it is.
The microphone up, thank
you. We make assumptions, which leads to, then we make conclusions based on the assumptions, which leads to beliefs, and then that leads to actions. And that's kind of like a healthy way of developing your belief systems and your actions, is to go through that process. But what he pointed out was that when we are in pain or we get hurt, we jump to conclusions or beliefs and actions. And I think that really resonated with me at that moment, but I think it's true for a lot of us. Mm-hmm. When someone says something or acts in a certain way and we get hurt, we immediately jump to conclusions about that person or whatever it is, and then we act on those, probably unskillfully and unwisely. And so that concept of the ladder has always been really important, to kind of just stop and say, wait a minute, am I jumping to conclusions or am I acting without really thinking about mm-hmm. what's happening?
Thank you. And what we're talking about is the ladder of inference. And you can Google that and look it up. And it's very interesting to look at how we take in data, what we do about it, how we make assumptions, the belief systems that we create out of that, and then what we do. What are our actions? And are we acting out of reactivity based on old beliefs, based on experiences that happened a long time ago that have colored our belief systems, or are we acting based on what's actually happening right now? So the ladder of inference is very interesting, and Donald does teach a lot about reactivity and the two arrows. Thank you for that. Yes, Jane?
Just thinking about the specifics that I'm living with right now.
Yeah.
Because I find I go through phases of the things that, that Donald and Sylvia both say resonate with me. And for the last quite some time, one of the things I use daily at the end of my meditation is setting an intention, which is something Donald has talked a lot about. And it just helps me look at my known part of the day and the people and situations and feel much more comfortable with what I anticipate. And then with Sylvia, I think humor is my... I have so much gratitude for her to the reminders of using humor in our lives. And that's made a huge difference for me.
Thank you. So I think we will end there. And I would like to end with a little more sitting. Let's just come back to coming into our motivations and our intentions. And we'll just take a few minutes. Once again, feeling your body sitting right where you are, the quality of your breath. And just settling in. A poem from Mark Nepo called Being Here. Transcending down into the ground of things is akin to sweeping the leaves that cover a path. There will always be more leaves, and the heart of the journey, the heart of our own awakening, is to discover for ourselves that the leaves are not the ground, and that sweeping them aside will reveal a path, and finally, that to fully live, we must take the path and continually sweep it. Transcending down into the ground of things is akin to sweeping the leaves that cover a path. There will always be more leaves, and the heart of the journey, the heart of our own awakening, is to discover for ourselves that the leaves are not the ground, and that sweeping them aside will reveal a path, and finally, that to fully live, we must take the path and continually sweep it. And as we go through the week, remembering that we can bring this practice with us in all of its different forms, wherever we are, whether it's attending to our bodies or the breath, our awareness. And we wish everybody everywhere peace and ease, the end of their suffering. We hold ourselves with kindness and compassion. And as always, knowing that the fruits of our efforts go far beyond ourselves. And taking with you whatever resonates and leaving behind whatever doesn't. May we all be peaceful and happy, come to the end of suffering.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.